I know we're all looking for that one thing that helps us drift off to dreamland. If my voice isn't really doing it for you lately, let me suggest what I've been trying. Introducing Dream Powder by Beam, your ticket to a night of restful, rejuvenating sleep. Imagine sipping on a delicious cup of hot cocoa that not only tastes heavenly, but also helps you get your best night's sleep, no matter your lifestyle. Simply pour 1 to 2 scoops into a mug of hot water or milk, blend or froth for that cozy finish, and sip 30 to 45 minutes before bed. You'll be amazed at how it helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up feeling refreshed with no grogginess. Dream powders come in a range of customizations, with ingredients like nano CBD, reishi, magnesium, L-theanine, and melatonin to naturally support your mood, stress, rest, and overall well-being. Plus, Dream Powder is gluten-free, dairy-free, vegan, non-GMO, and keto-friendly. With only 15 calories and no added sugar, it's a guilt-free treat that you can enjoy nightly. Prior to taking Dream, sometimes it was so difficult to wind down, and the quality of sleep has drastically risen with some serious deep REM sleep for a solid 8 hours. I don't need to pound 400 milligrams of caffeine just to get myself moving anymore, you know? And the greatest part about Dream is that it's such a joy to take in the fun cocoa powder that you just dump in some warm water, and it's delicious. Dream powder comes in a variety of flavors and potencies, so you can customize it to your lifestyle. Whether you choose the CBD or non-CBD version, it's a tasty nighttime hot chocolatey experience. But here's the cherry on the top. Subscribe via their website linked down below and save 20%. And when you use my code LETSREAD, you'll get an extra 15% off and a free frother. That's up to 35% off the original price. You can pause, skip, and cancel anytime, so there's absolutely no risk. Click the link down below and use my code LETSREAD at checkout to experience the joy of a perfect night's sleep with Dream Powder. Sweet dreams are just a sip away. Despite putting some 26 years into policing and receiving a medical retirement at age 48, thanks to some wannabe gangster with an itchy trigger finger, I wasn't nearly ready to quit working. The way I saw it, I was faced with two choices. I could move out to the sticks and hope some small-town sheriff's department has room for a crazy old deputy with a limp, or I could follow an ex-partner of mine into the wacky, well-paying world of private investigation. The idea of starting all over again in what is most definitely a young man's game was not appealing in the slightest. I've worked my butt off to get to a level of relative autonomy, and losing that would mean a big hit to both my ego and my style of investigation. Whereas, on the other hand, going to work with my ex-partner would mean better pay and more professional freedom. And when I thought of it like that, it didn't seem like I had much of a choice at all. One of the first things I was told was not to expect the same level of excitement or intensity as regular policing. I figured that went without saying, but when my first assignment involved getting to the bottom of some industrial sabotage at an upstate retirement home, I joked about having made a terrible mistake. I was fine with the change of pace and even referred to it as semi-retirement, so I really was only being sarcastic when I was told how boring PI work could be. Besides, putting me to work on a bunch of old-timers, real old-timers I mean, was exactly the kind of assignment I'd been hoping for. Anyway, the job went a little something like this. Over the last few months, a whole bunch of stuff had been either malfunctioning or going missing at this one particular retirement home. Management claimed it was industrial sabotage, and that it ranged from petty annoyances to dangerous errors with medications. They'd contacted the local police department several times, but each time, they'd been told it was an internal issue that needed to be resolved through human resources. Sure, taking the wrong meds had the potential to hurt someone, but until they did get hurt, or someone was caught dead to rights switching meds with malicious intent, there wasn't much the cops could do. My job was essentially to go in there, figure out who was causing all their problems, then give management a name. That was never going to happen exactly as described, as unless I too caught someone red-handed, The best I could do was draw up a short list of the most likely suspects and then leave it to management's better judgment. They tried figuring it out themselves, but as one nurse told me, they were medical professionals, not detectives, so as much as they had their suspicions, they couldn't act on anything without being rubber-stamped by management. But as it turns out, the solution that management had in mind was me. It billed itself as a retirement community, but the reality was it was anything but. Everyone seemed to dislike everyone else. Nobody really wanted to be there, and the place felt more cliquey and tribal than a high school. I thought that that might make things more difficult on my end, as in a situation like that, people tend to pin blame on each other for personal reasons, not logical ones. But strangely enough, almost everyone named the same person who I asked who they thought was guilty of the sabotage. At this particular retirement home, which shall remain anonymous, lived an old man we'll call Mr. Grouchy. Mr. Grouchy hated everyone and everything, but that wasn't the reason that people thought that he was the guilty party. People thought that he was the saboteur because apparently he told people that. Word was that Mr. Grouchy regularly threatened to break stuff, hide stuff, even toss stuff out of the window if he could, so naturally I decided to get his side of the story before making any accusations. When I first talked to him, Grouchy was just as ornery as people had described. He had no interest in talking to me until I mentioned being formal law enforcement, but even then, he only warmed up a little. He totally denied any wrongdoing, but when I politely asked him to propose an alternative explanation, he got to being all thorny again, before telling me to take a long walk off a short pier. It took a while to get him to start talking again, and at first, it was only to rant and rave about how much he hated living at the retirement home. But then, after a while of just hearing him out, Grouchy made a kind of admission. Although he had indeed been threatening to vandalize the retirement home, it wasn't Mr. Grouchy that had been tinkering with the boilers, switching medication and causing leaks in the building's roof. Only, he didn't mind that everyone thought that it was him, because he believed it would end with him getting kicked out. He wanted to leave the home, on account of the substandard care causing unnecessary deaths, but since management was so proficient at concealing the problem, his son wouldn't withdraw him from the retirement home, as it meant losing the yearly fees that he'd already paid. Essentially, despite being right on the cusp of manufacturing some scandal or crisis, Grouchy hadn't actually performed any sabotage. But according to Grouchy, the real crime wasn't commercial sabotage. It was the extreme negligence of management, which he claimed had caused many a resident to pass away before their time. Talking to Mr. Grouchy was the first I'd heard of any medical negligence on the part of the management or staff, and since it tied into my reasons for being there, I decided to press him on the issue. He was only able to give me one name, that of a woman we'll call the widow, but one was all he needed. When he first arrived, Grouchy had heard rumors that the nurses and care workers could be neglectful, but being the kind of man that he was, he figured they amounted to nothing but whining and griping. It wasn't until he saw it happen with his own eyes that he started to believe it. In the weeks before she died, the widow was feeling just peachy, but then one afternoon, she started complaining that she hadn't been given her medications. Grouchy conceded that plenty of the residents had become forgetful in their old age and would sometimes complain of not being given something when they'd received it less than an hour ago. Medications, lunch, bath time, you name it. Things would just slip their mind and it'd take a polite reminder from one of the care team to jog their memory. This meant that when she first complained of having not been given her meds, many assumed the widow was just being forgetful. It was only when she started to appear visibly unwell that the widow's fellow residents started to take her seriously. They did, but the nurses didn't. The widow got worse and worse, but whenever she complained, the staff would tell her what a crybaby she was being and would simply wheel her off to her bedroom for a nap. Grouchy said almost everyone could hear her crying for help, but again, only the bare minimum of care was provided. A few days later, she was dead. Grouchy said most residents treated the widow's death like an inevitable tragedy. Old people pass away in retirement homes. That's just a sad fact. But a handful of residents knew otherwise. Grouchy had been trying to escape ever since, and had tried to raise the issue of the widow's death with several people, his son included. But almost each and every person had told him that he was overreacting, or figured it was just a manifestation of his own mortal fears. I'll admit, I didn't quite know what to make of the accusations at the time. I wasn't about to throw my lot in with Mr. Grouchy, no matter how compelling a story he had made. I was there to find the saboteur, or if I wanted to get paid, I had to find him, and everything else could wait. I hate to disappoint, but there's no short and satisfying conclusion to this story. I didn't actually find the saboteur. I only got to drawing up a handful of suspects, Grouchy not included, before the situation took a dramatic turn. From what I could tell, most incidents of sabotage, such as med switching in particular, had occurred during the early morning or late evening times when most of the residents were asleep or in their rooms. There were also instances, such as the damage to the roof, that were well beyond the physical capabilities of an elderly person or infirm person to do. That meant that whoever was doing the damage, they were either a member of the care team or one of the contractors who came in to cook meals, make repairs, or deliver supplies. I was pursuing this line of inquiry one day when suddenly there was a commotion among some of the residents. I was making my way toward the scene of the disturbance when I spotted a number of nurses rushing out of the main entrance and into the parking lot outside. I followed them, but what we found was one of the most terrible things I've ever seen. The head of the care team, who we'll call Nurse A, was lying in a horrifically unnatural position in the parking lot. Residents said it looked like she had fallen from one of the second floor windows, and she had the injuries to match. But in reality, she hadn't fallen from a second floor window. She'd fallen from the roof. And you see, she hadn't just accidentally fallen. She'd been pushed. Just a few hours after the commotion started, my work had to be temporarily paused. What had once been the subject of my small-time investigation quickly became a full-fledged crime scene, and despite my credentials, I knew the cops wouldn't appreciate me hanging around and potentially slowing down their investigation. But before I departed for the day, I made sure to hang around long enough to give one of my crisp new business cards to the first cop who showed up. I told whoever ended up getting the case was welcome to give me a call, as I had some things that they might want to hear going on. I was working on the assumption that the nurse wasn't going to survive the fall. It certainly looked that way at the time. But miraculously, she did survive. And just a few weeks later, she was able to give a full account of what happened that day, along with a detailed description of the person who pushed her off the roof. In the end, my input wasn't needed at all. The suspect was tried and convicted on witness testimony alone. But I did feel a sliver of satisfaction knowing that I was almost halfway to finding my saboteur. Nurse A said that since the most recent of the sabotage incidents had been damage to the roof, she thought it suspicious when she noticed one of the contractors heading to the roof all alone. She waited a while, then followed him up there, only to find that he was ripping up tiles and putting holes in the roof under the pretense of making repairs. Nurse A confronted the man, having never expected to be tossed off the roof like she was. And when he grabbed and shoved her off the flat section of the roof, she thought it was the end of her. But one of her final thoughts before being thrown to what she assumed was her death was why. The suspect, a handyman who'd only been hired less than a year prior, had never shown any signs of being the saboteur. He'd always come to work, kept his head down, and did his job, and since everyone assumed the motive was personal, no one had ever considered him the culprit. No one except me. As I said, the only people who might blend in, while also having the means and tools to vandalize the property, were the contractors who came in once or twice a week to perform maintenance tasks. I had him down as a circumstantial suspect. I just had no idea why he might want to make life difficult or even deadly for the residents and staff, and even less of an idea why he might want to kill one of them to cover his tracks or otherwise. It was one of the cops who managed to figure it out. Then, all of a sudden, it makes sense why the perp seemed content to keep his mouth shut before pleading guilty at the hearing. This guy didn't care about going to prison for what he'd done, and it took one small piece of information for it all to make sense, or rather, what little sense there was to make. Although they didn't share the same family name, the handyman turned attempted murderer was none other than the biological son of the widow. He knew something wasn't right about his mother's death, but no one had offered him any help, especially not the management or staff of the retirement home. So instead of pursuing justice through the regular channels, he decided on a different course of action. Since he didn't share the same family name as his deceased mother, the handyman simply waited until there was an open position at the retirement home, then made an application. I heard handymen and various other contractors were always coming and going, so it didn't take long for the widow's son to get himself a place on the retirement home's staff. His plan was to bring the whole place down, piece by piece. He didn't just blame one or two people for his mom's death. He blamed the whole system and everybody inside of it, residents included. I guess Nurse A must have become the focal point of his rage, probably after having found out that she ran the care schedule and was generally responsible for everything pertaining to resident care. When she followed him up onto the roof like that, I suppose he just saw an opportunity and took it. Like I said, I was never able to prove that the handyman was the saboteur, not by any kind of professional standard anyway. But I'd like to think that this attempted murder was essentially an admission of guilt. I still handed in my list of suspects, but obviously it came with a caveat of sorts, explaining that I was 99.9% sure that the handyman was to blame for almost all incidents of vandalism, sabotage, and theft. Since the contract was fulfilled, we got paid, so that was the end of that. But the case has always stuck with me as one of the most bizarre and convoluted that I ever worked, including those that I took as a city detective. In all my years as a private investigator, there was only one job that I truly regret taking. In my experience, private eyes are a pretty unscrupulous bunch. As long as the job doesn't entail overtly breaking the law, you can expect that they'll get it done for the right fee. And even then, I've known one or two that didn't mind bending the rules if it meant getting their pay packet just that little bit faster. They don't care if their findings get someone sacked or ruin their marriage or any of the other things that can happen when a harsh truth comes to light. All that matters is getting paid. I can't say I conducted myself much differently during the second phase of my investigative career, the first being bound by the rules and regulations of the Metropolitan Police, but I was definitely pickier than most concerning which jobs I did and didn't take. A good example would be the heartbroken mother who paid me on 3 separate occasions to find evidence of her son's drug use. The 4th time she asked me, I refused to take her money just to come to the same old conclusions. She needed to spend her money on an addiction counselor and not another detective for hire. Aside from that, I was okay with almost anything that kept the checks rolling in, but then came the day when I discovered where my line was, and it's something I've never forgotten. One day I got a call from a gentleman who asked if I was free for a job. I asked him for a brief description of what he wanted me to do, and he told me the following. Ever since his wife had passed away, his 19-year-old daughter had been suffering from some increasingly severe mental health problems, and as a result, she'd fallen in with a bad crowd. By bad crowd, I thought that they meant some kind of people who went out drinking, smoking some hashish, and generally just making a nuisance of themselves. The man then confirmed that his daughter had been drinking and using drugs. That wasn't strictly the issue, though. The issue was that she'd run away to join what he described as a cult. His daughter had been in a terribly vulnerable state following the death of her mother, and the gentleman who called blamed himself for not being able to provide the right support due to his own grief-induced depression. The result was his daughter seeking paternal support elsewhere, and as it happened, she'd thrown her lot in with a group that was actively exploiting her for their own gain. I essentially cut him off at that point, as I'd already made up my mind to take the job. I then invited him down to my office to give me a more detailed rundown of the situation while providing me with any recent photographs of his missing daughter. The man who arrived at my office the next morning was about as unremarkable as you can imagine. Mid-40s, graying hair, fleece jacket, average as can be. But when you got a look at his face, I mean really looked him in the eyes, it was almost like he could see how the grief and stress had been eating away at him. At least, that's what I thought it was at the time. He provided me with some photos of his daughter in her younger years, but then he showed me some more recent photos, and the difference was night and day. She looked incredibly unhealthy, with big dark circles under her eyes. The picture had been taken from social media, so she was posing and smiling in it, but you could tell how much she was suffering, just from how pale and frail she looked. The man's daughter was posing with a friend of hers, but when I asked, her father said that she wasn't part of the suspected cult and that he'd be happy to put me in touch with her. The girls had been friends ever since they were children, but his daughter had become increasingly withdrawn from her regular social circle prior to her disappearance. This meant that, although she wanted to help, the friend had no idea where the man's daughter might have gone, only who she might have left with. The girl showed me a fairly recent group photograph that had been taken at some kind of party. Not everyone was facing the camera, and in the background was a boy that the missing girl had apparently been dating in the run-up to her disappearance. Her father had asserted that the boy was part of whatever cult she'd joined, and had in fact been the one to convert or induct her. The girl's friend said that she wasn't aware of any cult, but admitted that the boy had a lot of dark interests and had once boasted of an extensive collection of books related to serial killers and other such crimes against humanity. He'd also seemed very possessive and protective of the missing girl, something which struck the girl's friend as what she referred to as a red flag. Since her disappearance, the man's daughter appeared to have purged her social media presence, but her new boyfriend had not, and since he was classed as an open register on the local electoral roll, I was able to get a hold of his last known address with relative ease. Now, this isn't strictly how I got his address, but I'd rather not incriminate myself publicly, thanks. I then found myself at a small run-down council estate, one that was made up almost entirely of what were at the time new-build flats. You can always get into these places by just buzzing every buzzer. Someone's always expecting a pizza or a visitor or something, and even if they're not, they'll buzz you in out of sheer curiosity. I suppose that's why all of these things have got cameras now. You can only let so many burglars in before the technology is forced to advance. Anyway, I got up to this guy's flat, knocked on the door, and I'm there banging away for a good few minutes before a neighbor comes out and tells me that the occupant has moved on. I asked the neighbor if she had any idea where, but she didn't. She told me that she barely spoke to the boy, and then one day, all of his stuff was in bin bags or boxes, and he and the girl had been loading them into a van. I then showed her a picture of the man's daughter, and she confirmed that it was the same girl who had helped her neighbor move out. Anyone else might think that the trail had gone cold, but since I had his name, and since I knew the lad was claiming benefits, it was once again relatively easy to get a hold of his new address. I simply called up the local job seekers, told them that I was a potential employer but that I needed his address for a background check, and Bob's your mother's brother. I knew where he lay his head. Again, misrepresenting yourself like that isn't strictly legal, at least not when it comes to obtaining what's referred to as protected data, so trust me when I say it's not something I make a habit of. But like I said earlier, I felt absolutely heartbroken for this guy and his missing daughter, and I say that as the father of daughters myself. Every family goes through hard times, and every parent makes mistakes. But the guy had lost his wife, and he was about to lose his daughter. If I could put myself in the way of that, it'd be worth more than the pay at the end of the job. So I bent the rules a bit, and I found this lad's address. I did a few days' worth of surveillance on his block of flats, but I didn't see the missing daughter either enter or exit the building. I also followed the boyfriend around town for quite a bit, keeping an eye on who he met with, places he went, stuff like that. But as far as I could tell, he wasn't meeting with the missing daughter. He also didn't seem to be attending any kind of cult meetings either. He visited a local pub, did his shopping in a local supermarket, occasionally went drinking with friends in the city center, but otherwise kept himself out of trouble. It reached the point where not only was this potential boyfriend obviously not part of any cult, but he might also be concerned for the missing girl and might even be interested in helping find her. The only other prospective scenario was that the missing daughter had stayed in this lad's flat for days on end without leaving, and as far as I could tell, he was only buying enough food for one person. But again, appearances can be deceptive. He could have just as easily been keeping the girl prisoner, maybe feeding her very little, all part of some deranged course of brainwashing to induct her into the cult. I know it might sound a bit dramatic, but trust me, I've heard of much worse things, even seen a few with my own eyes, too. And part of the reason I regret this case so much is that I broke the private investigator's golden rule. You never, ever engage with a target, or anyone they're associated with that isn't privy to the investigation. People aren't stupid, and if they're on the run, they can be extra paranoid. Seeing a stranger hanging about, let alone one that asks questions or seems a bit too interested in them, can cause them to flee the area before you've ever had a chance to report them. And that's what this job consisted of. It was a location game. You return to the client with not just one address, but several, detailing where their missing person is, where they spent their time outside of their residence, things like that. Getting all that info takes time, and if you burn yourself, as some people call it, you have to start from scratch instead of just getting paid. It's like being meters away from the finish line at the end of a marathon, then watching it move another 20-something miles ahead of you. I hate to over-explain the point, but I need you to understand that in approaching the lad I had believed was the missing girl's boyfriend, I knew I was taking an unorthodox approach. But at the same time, I believed that I was facing an unorthodox situation, so I made the mistake of believing my methods had to match. I approached the boyfriend at the bar of the pub he liked to frequent, hoping a few pints might loosen his lips. He turned down my offer of a beer or two. Then when I approached him a second time just after the pub closed, he became downright aggressive when I brought up the prospect of him having some female company at home. I didn't ask in a seedy or disrespectful way. It was something along the lines of, "You have a wife or girlfriend that's going to be angry you stayed out for a few drinks?" He said no. Then when I probed a little more, he became extremely aggressive and accused me of one or two things I'd rather not repeat. My first thought was causing a scene to deter me from asking any further questions, which only renewed my suspicions that he was keeping the girl captive. This resulted in me casing his place for a few more days, brainstorming ways to look inside his flat, but then one night, the entire case climaxed with what was one of the most horrifying evenings of my entire life. I was parked opposite the boyfriend's block of flats, not immediately outside of it, but still in a position where I could see everyone going in and out. A taxi pulled up outside, so I grabbed my binoculars to get a look at whoever was getting out or getting in. When out from the block of flats steps a person I'd never seen before. I'd been keeping track, anyone and everyone who walked in or out of that front door, working out who lived there, who was just visiting, what time certain people departed for or arrived home from work. So when I saw this brand new person, all of a sudden, it caught my attention in a big way. I didn't get a look at their face thanks to the dark, oversized hoodie that they were wearing, but I was almost 100% certain that, physically speaking, they matched the description of my missing female. She gets into the waiting taxi. I rush to get in position to follow. Then I tail the cab all the way into the town center where the girl gets out. I overtook the stationary taxi, making sure to get a good look at the person who got out, and when I saw her face, I recognized her immediately. It was the missing girl, the person I'd been hunting for the better part of a month. It's always a massive adrenaline rush when you finally make that big find, so I was in a cackling good mood after that, having no clue at all what was about to happen just a few minutes later. I had to keep driving for a bit before I could turn around to head back, but when I saw her walking up the pavement towards me, I pulled over to the side of the road on the opposite side to her, got out of my car, then crossed the road to intercept her. All I did was offer her help and tell her that her father missed her very much. She froze, looked me in the eye, and asked me if that's who'd sent me, her father, I mean. And when I said yes, she turned, waited for just a few seconds, then threw herself under the wheels of a passing car. The sound it made as it drove over her is something that will haunt me for the rest of my life. I stood there in shock for what felt like a very long time, staring at a girl that had been alive and talking just moments before, but was now twisted up, barely recognizable, and almost certainly deceased. I think I took my phone out and dialed 999 almost subconsciously because when I heard the operator's voice in my ear, it's like it brought me out of a deep daze. The ambulance crews arrived as quickly as they could, but from what I could tell, there was nothing they could do for the poor girl except cart her off to the coroner. She was gone. There was no bringing her back. As much as I could have let the police do their job, I took it upon myself to deliver the bad news to her father. I'm not sure what I was thinking, and this last part only adds to the deep sense of regret that I feel regarding what is undoubtedly the worst case I've ever dealt with. But it wasn't the act of telling him that I truly regret. It was seeing his reaction. I called the girl's father and insisted that we meet in person as soon as possible. A few hours later, I was knocking on his door, with his home being situated in a well-to-do borough of London. He invited me into his sitting room. I asked him to sit down, and when he did so, I delivered the bad news as delicately as possible. In my experience, people react to the news that a loved one has died in a variety of different ways. But without a doubt, the worst reactions come from parents who find out that they've lost a child. It's a pain I can barely even imagine, but when I told my client that his daughter had been in an accident of her own creation and that she was most likely deceased, he barely batted an eyelid. I could tell that he was trying to conceal his emotions, but if those emotions were grief, it was unlike any type of grief I'd ever seen before. If I'm being honest, it looked a lot more like relief or satisfaction than shock or grief, and to this day, I'm very haunted by it. I think I was too shaken up at the time to really think about what I was seeing. Despite my many years in policing and PI work, I'd only ever seen one person killed before that night, and it wasn't anywhere near as brutal or shocking a fashion. So, it's safe to say that I wasn't in my usual frame of mind when I delivered that news. I apologized for being the bearer of this bad news, told him that I wasn't expecting any kind of payment, and then departed his property and went back to my hotel room. But before I left, he said to me, "Thank you." And by God, he meant it. He was glad that she was dead, and I know that now, and the weapon he'd used to kill her was me. It was only the next morning, once my head had properly cleared, that I realized what exactly it was that I'd done. I hadn't been rescuing a girl from a cult. There was no cult. I think a deeply abusive father had hired me, or more accurately, tricked me into tracking down his daughter, who'd made a very courageous bid to escape him. Then, when she realized that he'd never just let her go, she decided to take her own life rather than face the prospect of seeing him again. Now I know what you might be thinking, and trust me, I've asked myself the same question many times. Why not just move on somewhere else? Why opt for taking your own life instead of continuing to evade him? I don't have a straight answer for that myself. I think I could investigate for 20 years and still never really know what happened in that family. The father would never willingly talk about it, and the only two witnesses were buried next to each other, having taken their secrets to their graves. I'd like to tell you that I've since dedicated myself to bringing that girl to justice and exposing whatever evil was being inflicted on her by her own flesh and blood. But real life isn't like films or books, and I'm not in any sort of position to be working a long-term job like that for free. I suppose I could try and maybe crowdfund it or something. I hear that's very popular these days, but I've learned over the years that there are some cases that you never get any answers from. Best thing you can do is just forget it and try and move on. After all, there's always another case, another mystery to obsess over. On the afternoon of September 16th, 2015, Susie Flanagan attempted to call her husband on his cell phone. 55-year-old Greg Flanagan was on a business trip in East Texas, having been charged with negotiating mineral rights on private property for gas and oil corporations. His work took him on the road a lot, so Susie was accustomed to her husband's brief but frequent absences. But he always picked up his phone whenever she called, or if he didn't, he made sure to call her back at the first available juncture. Yet after checking into room 348 of the MCN Elegante Hotel during the previous evening, Greg had been completely silent, having failed to pick up or return any of his wife's calls. Susie tried calling one of her husband's co-workers, only to hear that Greg hadn't shown up to a morning meeting. Susie then begged Greg's co-workers to drive over to his hotel to check up on him, and with the help of the manager, they gained access to his room. Greg was lying prone, just inches from his bed. His face was buried in the carpet, while his skin had turned a sickly grayish-blue, and pinched neatly between two fingers of one hand was a burned-out cigarette butt. No one needed to check his pulse to know that he was dead, and the group was shocked into stunned silence for a few moments before heading out of the room again in a state of near catatonia. The next person to walk into room 348 was an officer of the Beaumont Police Department, and at first, Officer Scott Apple spotted no signs of foul play. Greg's wallet appeared untouched, his watch and cell phone were present, and there were no signs of any forced entry or violent struggle. To all outside observers, Greg's death was entirely natural, and even his wife agreed that his lifestyle verged on self-destructive. He smoked excessively, he drank like a fish, eschewed all forms of exercise, and sustained himself almost entirely on cold cuts and grilled cheese sandwiches. Susie also maintained that at the time of her husband's death, he hadn't been to a doctor in almost 10 years. She warned Greg time and time again that one day his contempt for his own health was going to catch up to him, and now it appeared that he'd been forced to pay the piper. Greg's autopsy was performed by Dr. Thomas Brown, a highly respected and regionally renowned physician with almost 40 years of experience. He noted an inch-long abrasion on Greg's left cheek, most likely from where his face hit the carpet following loss of consciousness, along with a tiny laceration near his groin. These wounds were consistent with someone who died a sudden but natural death, yet inside his body, the cause of Greg's death appeared anything but natural. There was extensive damage to Greg's internal organs, including lacerations to his liver and stomach, tearing in his intestines, and catastrophic damage to his heart. Almost every single one of Greg's internal organs had been crushed, smashed, or otherwise damaged in what could only have been a sustained act of physical violence. The news came as a huge shock to Greg's friends and relatives, who were almost certain his unhealthy lifestyle was to blame for his death. The idea that someone had gained access to his room, then beaten him to death, was almost incomprehensible. Greg might not have had the sunniest of personalities, but he had no enemies. So who in the world would want to take his life in such a blunt and brutal fashion? And how had such devastating internal injuries been incurred without a trace of external damage? Now faced with a homicide investigation, Officer Apple got to work piecing together the case's many details and, in doing so, discovered a clue of huge potential value. During his last night on Earth, Greg attempted to microwave some popcorn, but only succeeded in tripping the fuse for his entire floor. So in the wee small hours of September 16th, he called down to the hotel's front desk and requested a maintenance man. According to the clerk on duty that night, a maintenance man was sent to Greg's room and the situation was resolved. Yet it presented Officer Apple with an interesting prospect. The maintenance man had quite obviously accessed Greg's hotel room, potentially making him the last person to see Greg alive and therefore a prime suspect in his murder. This maintenance man staunchly denied any wrongdoing, but he was later discovered to have prior convictions for indecent assault. Greg hadn't been violated, nor had his body been desecrated, but the involvement of a convicted felon could never be entirely ruled out. For a brief period, police police considered the involvement of two area electricians who had been called out to the hotel on the morning after the power outage. Both visited Greg's room, but neither mentioned any violent struggle or dead body. Sadly, despite a number of suspects, the investigation into Greg's murder began to stall, and as time went by, it became one of East Texas's most puzzling cold cases. As months ticked over into years, Greg's widow grew increasingly impatient with the lack of justice. Although she had taken the news of the natural death in her stride, the revelation that her husband was murdered had filled her with a grim determination. No matter how upsetting it proved, she needed to know what happened on the night of her husband's death. Convictions and justice be damned, she just wanted to know the truth, and her search for answers brought her to the doorstep of one of the most storied private detectives of our era, Mr. Ken Brennan. Due to his long career in law enforcement, 60-year-old Brennan was no stranger to suspiciously sudden deaths, and he knew if they wished to track down Greg's killer, every little detail mattered. He grilled Susie Flanagan on the circumstances of her husband's death, prying into his personal life in the hopes of uncovering some small but significant attribute. In the end, it was two minor details that Brennan began to fixate on. The first was that at the time of Greg's body being found, the air conditioning unit in his room had been switched off. September temperatures in Beaumont can reach the mid-80s, and Greg was known to crank his AC nice and high during the year's hotter months. Whoever had killed him wanted to accelerate the decomposition process, possibly as a way of desecrating his body and possibly as a way of ensuring that it would be found quickly. The second detail involved Greg Flanagan being right-handed. Susie confirmed that her husband always held his cigarette in his right hand, but when his body was found, the burned-out butt was pinched between fingers on his left hand. To Brennan, it seemed very possible that the cigarette had fallen out of Greg's right hand during the attack, only for his killer to place it in his left hand, in the hopes that it might burn up the hotel room and remove forensic evidence. As the investigation progressed, it looked more and more like Greg Flanagan had been murdered by a professional, a contract killer who'd been given the task of making his death look either natural or accidental. The only other suspects were the two electricians who, rather than visiting the hotel to make repairs, had actually been guests in a room right next to the victims. Hotel staff confirmed that the off-duty electricians had been heavily intoxicated on the night of Greg's murder, and Brennan suspected that an argument between the two parties may have been the catalyst for Greg's murder. Brennan reached out to some of the hotel's other guests, but rather than implicate themselves, one of them offered up a very compelling piece of information. One of the guests mentioned hearing a gunshot in the early hours of September 16th. He admitted to being half asleep at the time, but claimed that he was 100% certain that a gun had been fired in the hotel. This report stood in stark contrast to all those who claimed that there had been no disturbances on the night of Greg's murder. And when Ken Brennan initially chose to investigate such assertions, it was merely to prove that the guest was either lying or mistaken. But he was not lying. And when Brennan drove back to room 348 of the Elegante Hotel, he found what he was looking for. After noticing a small divot in the wall behind the hotel room's door, Brennan initially dismissed its damage resulting from the door handle hitting the interior wall. But after opening the door fully, Brennan discovered that the handle impacted the wall to the far right of where the divot was located. The small hole hadn't been caused by the door's handle, and upon further investigation, it appeared to have been filled in and patched with something that smelled like dried mint toothpaste. It wasn't just a small piece of cosmetic damage. It was a bullet hole. After shining a laser pen through the hole, Brennan quickly determined that the bullet's trajectory lined up almost perfectly with where Greg was thought to have been sitting at the time of his death. But if he had indeed been killed by a single bullet which tore through the wall of his hotel before entering his body, how had the county coroner failed to notice such a significant detail? To confirm his theory, Brennan had to petition for Greg's body to be exhumed and re-examined, but to his frustration, he learned that Greg had been cremated shortly after his funeral service. Instead, Brennan reached out to Dr. Thomas Brown and urged him to take another look at the photographs taken from Greg's autopsy. Dr. Brown agreed that, at least in theory, a bullet could have caused the same amount of damage to his internal organs, but it wasn't until he remembered the small wound near Greg's groin that he realized just how much he'd missed the mark. Since the skin near a person's groin is soft and easily bent, the wound didn't stand out as an obvious entry wound, but in light of the mysterious damage to Greg's internal organs, little else could explain such a mysterious wound. Brennan believed that the trajectory of the bullet meant that it could have only been fired from room 349, the same room the two electricians had been staying in. Lance Mueller and Tim Steinmetz had never been completely ruled out as suspects, but in light of the story they'd already given, it was doubtful that they were the guilty party. However, in light of the new evidence regarding the bullet hole, the two men were re-interviewed by Brennan, and it was then that a shocking admission was made. On the night of Greg's death, Lance Mueller admitted to having been playing with a 9mm pistol whilst intoxicated. The gun accidentally went off, but since the shot was greeted with nothing but silence, the two men figured no one had heard the shot, let alone been wounded or killed by it. That night might well have remained silent, but a terrified Mueller returned to his car, hid the pistol, and then spent the night at the hotel bar before checking out at the first available juncture. Both men had noticed swarms of police officers when driving past the hotel later that day, and both had wondered if their presence was related to the accidental gunshot. It was only when contacted by Brennan that they realized that there was no point hiding anymore. Their stupid, drunken mistake had cost a man his life, and it was time to own up to what they'd done. Lance Mueller was later charged with manslaughter, and after pleading guilty, he received 10 years in prison. At his trial, Susie Flanagan was given the chance to read a victim impact statement to her husband's killer, and it reads as follows. "I have waited over 2 years to look you in the face eye to eye and simply have the chance to speak directly to you," she said. "You would never have come forward with the truth. You murdered him. No, you didn't intentionally seek out to murder him, but you murdered him. With every lie you told, with every intentional selfish deception, with every cover-up, over and over again. You saw his body taken out of the room in a body bag the next day. You knew you killed him. He meant nothing to you. But you've met your match. I would have spent the rest of my life tracking you down. And I found you, Greg's murderer. I brought you to justice." Mueller was said to look stunned as his victim's widow delivered her speech. Susie Flanagan was said to have only barely contained her rage. But as Susie herself later said, it wasn't anger that had her eyes bulging and her hands trembling. It was the adrenaline of knowing justice had been served when, for so long, it seemed as though her husband's murder would go unsolved. Detective Ken Brennan might have been the facilitator of that justice, but it was Susie who pushed for it in the first place. It was she who applied for a tax extension so she could afford Brennan's fees. It was she who refused to accept a life of hopeless wandering. And although it was the bang of a judge's hammer that signaled the beginning of Mueller's sentence, it was Susie Flanagan alone who strived to put him behind bars. Angela Marie Simoda was born on September 19th of 1964 in Alameda County, California. After graduating from high school, she studied computer science and electrical engineering at the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. She was described as intelligent and outgoing, but her academic success was no doubt due to the relentless hard work that she was known for. Angela would often stay awake until the small hours of the morning, poring over textbooks, reviewing papers, and reading through seminar notes gleaned from juniors and seniors. Yet somehow, she still maintained an active social life and was popular among her peers. On the evening of October 12, 1984, Angela and two friends visited the Texas State Fair before moving on to a nightclub known as the Rio Room. The trio danced until the early hours of the following morning, whereupon a perfectly sober Angela gave them both a ride home. She then briefly stopped at her boyfriend's place, then made her way back to her own apartment on Amesbury Drive in Northeast Texas. Angela's boyfriend, Ben McCall, had asked her to call him when she'd arrived back at home. But when the call came at around 1:45 in the morning, Angela sounded terrified. She told Ben that there was a man in her apartment and that he was demanding to use her phone and bathroom. Ben asked how the man had gotten into her apartment and if she needed him to call the cops. Angela didn't answer either question and told Ben that she'd call him back before abruptly ending the call. He never heard from her again. In the minutes that followed, Ben paced back and forth in his bedroom, slowly descending into full-blown panic. He tried calling Angela back, then again and again and again, but each time, his phone calls went unanswered. Ben McCall then immediately contacted the Dallas Police Department and rushed over to Angela's apartment to meet them. Officers found Angela's door unlocked, and when they walked inside and searched the apartment, they found Angela's lifeless body. She had been stripped, violated, and then stabbed to death. Police began to heavily suspect that Angela's killer had been the male friend she took to the Texas State Fair that night. Russell Buchanan admitted to being heavily intoxicated on the night in question, but despite his claim that he went straight to bed after being given a ride back home, he had no solid alibis for the hours that followed. Some officers speculated that Buchanan had been a secret admirer of Angela's, and then after a night of drinking and dancing, decided to walk over to her place for a romantic proposition. Then, enraged by her rejection, he attacked, violated, and ultimately killed her. Buchanan staunchly denied the accusation, but despite there being no solid proof of his guilt, a dark cloud of suspicion seemed to follow him wherever he went. As far as the police were concerned, Russell Buchanan was innocent until proven guilty, but in the court of public opinion, he was a pervert and a murderer. After receiving news of her murder, Angela's roommate found herself paralyzed with guilt. Sheila Wasaki had been visiting her mother on the night of Angela's murder and believed Angela would still be alive had she remained home. Sheila found herself unable to return to Dallas Southern Methodist University, and for 20 long years, she was haunted by the prospect of being partly responsible for her roommate's death. Then, sometime in 2004, Sheila experienced something that would change her life forever. One night, after a long period of Bible study, Sheila claimed that she experienced a kind of vision. In this vision, she was visited by her long-deceased roommate, Angela, and although no words were spoken, Sheila understood what was being asked of her. In the months that followed, Sheila dedicated herself to the study of Angela's murder. She researched arrests for similar crimes that occurred around fall of 1984, and after consulting with officers from the Dallas Police Department, Sheila came to a compelling conclusion. She discovered that at the time Angela was killed, a 36-year-old man named Donald Bess had been released on parole after serving a 25-year sentence for kidnap, assault, and violation. Dallas PD had Bess's DNA on file, and thanks to advancements in forensic technologies, they would be able to compare the DNA samples recovered from Angela's bedroom to those on Bess's file. Yet by some horrendous twist of fate, just days before the DNA analysis was set to be performed, a freak flash flood rushed through the city of Dallas and destroyed huge portions of their DNA evidence, including those pertaining to the murder of Angela Simoda. Sheila was devastated and questioned why God would allow Angela to appear to her only to snatch away their path to justice at the very last moment. But according to Angela, the flood was akin to a biblical test of faith, as just weeks later, she received yet another surprising phone call. It was a member of the Dallas Police Department, one with incredible news to share. Some of the DNA records pertaining to Angela's murder had accidentally been misfiled and sent to another department. That department then audited its DNA files, discovering the discrepancy, then contacted Dallas PD to return the evidence. It was nothing short of a miracle, and within days, the DNA samples taken from under Angela's fingernails were compared to those on Donald Bess's file. It was a perfect match. Following Bess's arrest, multiple women came forward to claim that they too had been victims, and at his trial, it became evident that the man was a highly dangerous serial predator who had been hunting for potential victims on the night he found Angela. Bess pleaded not guilty, but was found guilty of first-degree murder and then sentenced to death by a jury of his peers. It was a day of incredible relief for Russell Buchanan, who had finally been publicly exonerated. In a statement to the press, he thanked the Dallas PD but reserved a special thank you to Sheila Wasaki, who was most certainly the driving force behind Bess's eventual conviction. To this day, Sheila continues to work as a private investigator and has since based her business in the state of Tennessee. She credits Angela with being the inspiration behind her work and considers solving cold cases her God-given purpose. "I can't turn back the clock and stop what happened to Angela," she told one journalist, "but I can help catch the kind of people who do something so evil. Every investigation I conclude makes the world a better place, and to me, there's no surer path to glory than that." Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursday nights. I'd love to see you there. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, or over email, and you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button over here on YouTube to hear about the extra perks that are offered for the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations and save huge on data. Located anywhere you listen to podcasts, and new episodes out every Tuesday at noon. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, that FEMA alert, about to get you.